Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Jerusalem for an update on the mood in Israel as the military assault on Gaza continues. And because a Hamas rocket landed a mile from Ben-Gurion Airport, U.S. airlines have cancelled flights into Israel due to safety concerns. Asher Kaufman, a professor of history and peace at Notre Dame, and the former head of Middle East Studies at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, joins us to discuss the overwhelming support in the press and among the Israeli people for the Gaza operation and the absence of a political opposition as Israel's politics move further to the right. Then we will speak with Leila Hilal, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation who served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiations Department and as an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team at the Annapolis Bilateral Peace Talks of 2008. We will discuss the continuing intense bombardment of Gaza as U.S. and U.N. diplomats pursue peace talks to end the fighting that has claimed over 625 Palestinians, mostly civilians, including 100 children, with 183 militants killed, according to the Israeli military, while so far two Israeli civilians have died, along with 27 soldiers. Then finally, we'll look into Tuesday's Republican primary in Georgia and assess the fortunes of Democrats running in the South, where a number of incumbents are facing well-financed Koch brothers-funded challenges, while two Democratic challengers, Alison Grimes, who could upset Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, and Michelle Nunn, running for the U.S. Senate in Georgia, both look promising for Democratic pickups. Bob Moser, senior editor at National Review and executive editor of The American Prospect, where he has an article, A Bridge in Georgia, joins us to discuss how these candidates running as Republican light in red states can inspire the Democratic base to come out in a midterm election. And joining us now from Jerusalem is Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, and he headed its Middle East unit. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, and his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syrian-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me.
And there are reports today that the U.S. air carriers are not flying into Ben-Gurion Airport because apparently Hamas rockets fell about a mile away from the airport. What other news is happening today in terms of what's happening on the ground in Israel vis-a-vis the military assault on Gaza?
Well, in Israel, the mood is, generally speaking, very bleak on one hand, and at the same time, there is much support for this military campaign that has been happening in Gaza. And that decision by U.S. Air carriers, I think, only adds to the sense of general pessimism about any impending ceasefire. That there are very few people here are optimistic about it, about reaching a ceasefire at this moment.
But there's a contradiction, surely, Asher Kaufman. On the one hand, you're saying the mood is bleak, and yet people support Netanyahu's government and its use of military force in Gaza. What is the explanation for pessimism in the face of military triumphalism?
Pessimism about the general situation. If you live in Tel Aviv, then a few times a day you have to abide by the sirens that you hear in the air around the Gaza Strip. It's even more serious, the issue of sirens and the risk of being hit by these rockets, or at least there is a general sense of danger in the air. Obviously not as much as it is in Gaza, the Gaza itself, where the situation is far, far worse. But at the same time, it is also accompanied with a sense of, this time we have to go all the way in. We have to be far more aggressive than we were before to once and for all resolve this problem in Gaza, which I agree with you. There is, you can see it as a contradiction, but this is what I see here. What I see is happening here.
So, is there any sense, though, in Israel and in the press, that this being drawn into Gaza for the Israelis to put boots on the ground is exactly what Hamas wants, that this is a tactic that Hezbollah learned in the last war against Israel? You fire rockets and hide in tunnels, and the only way that the Israelis can stop the rocket fire is to put boots on the ground, and that levels the playing field for Hamas because of the narrow alleys. They can booby trap everything, and that way right. They get to cause Israeli military casualties.
Yes. No, I agree with your analysis, but very few people here see it this way. I fully agree with what you've just said. I think Israel is just clearly has fallen into the, if you want, the trap that Hamas has created in recent days or since this operation began. But right now, the mood in Israel is, all in all, it's the chorus line. Almost everybody across the board, the media here, is in full support of this operation with the false hope that this time this would be it. This time we will be able to, you know, take care of this this problem. So despite the mounting number of casualties, what you get here is in fact a growing support for this military operation. You see here now the public donating stuff for the soldiers in Gaza. There is a general mobilization of the civilian population here in support of the operation. And very few people here, really on the margins, criticize the operation.
Again, I'm speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace. He's the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon. And his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflicts at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. And he joins us from Israel. What about, though, Asher Kaufman, the growing outrage around the world against Israel's military assault on Gaza? Here in the United States, the press and the politicians are certainly still in favor of Israel, although there are some voices in the media speaking out. Jon Stewart on The Daily Show sort of made fun about the idea that there's a kind of orthodoxy in the press where you can't criticize Israel in a comical way. The British Labour Party has condemned the Gaza incursion. Prime Minister Cameron, of course, previously referred to Gaza as an outdoor prison. Is there a sense in Israel that they may be losing their support around the world?
No, actually, interestingly, even this has not really reached here the general public. The media still sends a message that Israel enjoys international support, legitimacy for this operation, and that the criticism comes from the margins of the international community or from fringe leftists, pro-Muslim, pro-Arab groups in France and elsewhere in Europe. But if you read the mainstream media here, they report on international reaction as all in all supportive and understanding of Israel. So even that, what you get is, I would think, pretty much a disconnect from what you have described earlier. Growing criticism. You don't see that here.
Well, that's an ironic situation. Isn't that rather ironic? Because there's a free press in Israel. I mean, it's certainly the case in Russia, where Russians are in an alternative universe as far as what's happening in Ukraine. And there's a massive propaganda machine basically telling them that black is white and white is black. But it surprises me that I thought that there was a fairly robust and free press in Israel.
The press is free in Israel, still free, but first the press has really, with very few exceptions, has criticized this operation, and second has followed the line that is pumped by our prime minister, that we have international legitimacy because we were very cautious at the beginning, because we supported the ceasefire, because we didn't really want it at the beginning, from the very beginning. We didn't want this operation to take place, and that all in all we are defending ourselves, and that the free world understand that we are defending ourselves. And at least for now, if you look at, as you said yourself, I mean, the American administration has shown remarkable support, almost surprising support at Israel, towards Israel in this incursion.
Well, it is extraordinary, though, that the events leading up to this crisis, as you mentioned, that the Netanyahu government is able to use that as evidence that this has got international legitimacy. I fail to see that, because if you start with the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers who were subsequently murdered, according to the New York Times, Shin Bet knew right away. They were apparently, one of the boys had managed to get a phone call off, and they heard the gunshots and there was blood in the car. They knew that the boys were dead, but yet somebody in a high place in the Israeli government decided to string this thing out and to hold out false hope that these boys were alive. And then, by the way, then Netanyahu blamed Hamas for this, when normally they take credit for whatever they do, and in this case they didn't. So there's no concrete proof that Hamas did it. And then you had the hideous murder in retaliation of the Palestinian boy who was made to drink gasoline and then burned alive. And my understanding is that in a cabinet meeting, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, challenged Netanyahu's manhood and basically said, you don't have the cojones to go after Hamas. So is this thing being driven by the Israeli right or the far right?
I mean, you know, you pointed a question of where to start in your analysis of this current incursion. Mm-hmm. And you started with the kidnapping of the three Israeli youth and the subsequent murder, and then the Israeli reaction to this to the kidnapping. And very few analysts here in Israel make that connection. Mm-hmm. Again, this is right now in Israel, people do not focus on these issues. The way it is analyzed here in the press is, for the most part, with a few exceptions, that you know, it's Hamas started, and we have to defend ourselves. And again, I agree with your analysis that if you want to really understand how it unfolded, you have to start at least with the kidnapping of the three, and the fact that the government in Israel used that opportunity to crack down on Hamas activists in the West Bank, arresting so many of Hamas people here at the West Bank, and so on and so forth, and from there, things just turned and eventually led to where we stand now. But you really will not hear that. You will not see that analysis now in Israeli mainstream media.
So since you teach at Notre Dame and have lived and grew up in Israel and taught at Hebrew University, and clearly you're in Israel now, have you noticed over the last decade or so that the country is moving to the right? Apparently there have been some fairly ugly manifestations of demonstrations in the street by right-wing gangs. There's football team in Jerusalem.
There is no question that the country is moving to the right. I mean, that has been manifested, you know, fairly consistently in recent years, over a decade or so. But it is more than just moving to the right. What you see is very ugly hatred, animosity towards towards Arabs. This is something that I have not seen before. I mean, I was if you look at even the heyday of the Second Intifada, when suicide bombers, Palestinian suicide bombers, were blowing up at the center towns here in from 2001 to 2004-5, you didn't see so much hatred and venom in the streets as you see it now. It's really bleak, very bleak.
So that is not likely to be reversed, I take it. There's no countervailing political movements. The peace movement seems to be fairly moribund, and the Israeli left politically doesn't seem to have much clout. The center, I know the justice minister did at the time of the disappearance of the teenagers, she made statements against these price tag retributions by the Israeli right against the Palestinians. So what's your sense then of whether there can be a political countervailing movement created? Obviously, under these conditions, with a war going on in Gaza next door, it's not likely to happen. But assuming that this Gaza episode ends up as fruitless as it's likely to, that they won't really stop Hamas, they won't get any of the top leaders, they'll suffer more casualties and they'll be further alienated from the world community, what happens next?
What happens next is that we will be at the same place as we were before, only maybe even worse. I mean, every cycle of violence like this only takes us back further in any, you know, towards away from any prospect of constructive change here. And there is not really some counterbalance to the right-wing tendencies that have taken over Israeli society. I mean, there is no counter-movement to what is happening, what has happened in Israel in recent years, and no counter-movement to what is happening now in Gaza. There have been a few demonstrations of the left against the war, but the number of participants is very small, and there are always countered, these left-leaning demonstrations. They're always countered by right-wingers who violently come and try to disrupt the peaceful demonstrators. And so, unfortunately, I don't have any positive notes to make about the future here, at least as far as immediate future and thoughts about positive change or positive movement towards some kind of political process.
Well, Asher Kaufman, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, where he headed up its Middle East unit. He's the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon. And his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syrian-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. And he joined us from Jerusalem. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a former advisor to the Palestinian negotiating teams.
That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer.
Mr. War not the answer.
Politician and them bobo nyatin, yeah. War is not the answer. But the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Me tell the politician and them start.
Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Leila Hilal, who is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Previously, she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiations Department and advised the Palestinian Constitutional Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law. She acted as an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team as part of the Annapolis Bilateral Peace Talks of 2008 and was also a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leila Hilal.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And the situation in Gaza just seems grimmer and grimmer. And I just previously spoke with a scholar in Jerusalem who was describing the mood in Israel of being extremely pro-war. The press is all gung-ho. There is virtually no political opposition, at least speaking out. Small demonstrations, which are largely overrun by right-wing thugs. So it's pretty grim as far as that's concerned in terms of any possibility of a peace movement here and of peace talks underway with the UN and the US. At the same time, Gaza's being pounded. So do you see any light here?
Well, I think that indeed one of the unfortunate consequences of the current hostilities is that it is radicalizing both populations and moving each side farther from a position of being able to dialogue and find common ground on the fundamentals of the conflict. Certainly amongst the Israelis, as you mentioned, there is overt instances of racism and a goading of this onslaught by the Israeli military. But on the Palestinian side, the effect of so many thousand casualties and hundreds killed and many, many displaced, I think will continue to promote radicalization within Gaza. And we are seeing manifestations of that in terms of a recalcitrance on the part of Hamas to commit to minimal terms for a ceasefire. Not without cause, I think, but the fact is that neither side really is looking at compromise as a way out of this.
Well, this situation is surely putting pressure on the Palestinian Authority. They must look completely irrelevant at this point. And how long can they keep their populations invested in a two-state solution that's increasingly unlikely?
Well, I think that that's a very good and important question here. We have a situation of ongoing Israeli occupation over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The PA, which is led by Mahmoud Abbas, is based out of the West Bank, but is now in Cairo with Secretary Kerry and others, or was recently in Cairo with the major actors attempting to negotiate a ceasefire. Hamas is not represented, and so it is. There is an attempt to try to make the PA and Abbas the winner of this whole game, if you will, to be able to deliver a de-escalation. Meanwhile, it is Hamas that has to say ultimately that it will stop or continue this rocket fire, which is a major element in the conflict. And so so people are looking at what Hamas is doing, what is it is achieving, because in fact it's rocket fire has been the only way to get Israel really to respond. Capturing soldiers, etc., has been an effective tool to get an Israeli response. Whereas Abbas, which is promoting and participating in peace processes, has not been able to get anywhere. So there is now an attempt to reassert his authority in this configuration, will it be able to take hold, I think, is a big question, especially when people are, Palestinians are becoming more and more frustrated due to the circumstances on the ground in both the West Bank and now dramatically in Gaza.
Well, it would seem, though, that the mood from what Asher Kaufman just told us from Jerusalem was that this time around we're really going to solve this problem with Hamas. In other words, we're going to have a definitive result. And that seemed highly unlikely, that they won't really capture any of the top people or kill any of the top people. You can't, you know, there's 1.8 million people there, after all, in this tiny little area. It just seems that this is a chimera on the part of the Israelis, and that apparently is whether Netanyahu's promised this is apparently the way that the Israeli people feel, according to our previous guest. So how long are they going to pound the rubble until they realize the futility of what they're doing?
Well, the stated goal of the ground operation is to destroy the tunnels, and the tunnels of the Israelis say are being used to bring in weapons that are used to or equipment that's being used to make rockets or rockets themselves, and also the tunnels are being used to conduct ground operations inside Israel. And that bar, if you will, of destroying the tunnels, some people say was set in order to give Israel a way out, essentially. In other words, they know that, what you're saying, it is a futile exercise to think that they are going to eradicate the frustration and the anger that is represented in this rocket fire. But they need to attempt to put a cap on their activity, so they will be able to say, okay, we have conducted this ground operation for more than whatever it be, 7 days when they accept the ceasefire, when it will be, they will be able to say to the Israeli public that they've significantly destroyed these tunnels, which really ultimately can't be measured because there's no way for us as observers or the public to be able to say that this has been achieved. So it is a very nebulous goal, and the question just is, when will the Israelis decide that they can no longer take their own casualties, and when is the right wing adequately satisfied? On the Palestinian side, they're also asking themselves this question within Hamas circles, I'm sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Leila Hilal, who's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and previously she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiations Department and advised the Palestinian Constitutional Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law. She acted as an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team as part of the Annapolis Bilateral Peace Talks of 2008, and was also a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. So is there any, in this current agony, Leila, is there any sense that people are recognizing the roots of this situation, which go back to 1948, when the Palestinians were essentially evicted from Jaffa and other parts of Israel and just herded down into the Gaza Strip? The British Prime Minister David Cameron has referred to Gaza as an outdoor prison. Most analysts suggest that the 67 war is what created this problem with the Palestinians, but it precedes the 67 war, doesn't it?
Yes. The Gaza Strip was not its own historical territory. It is essentially was created in the demarcation of a line as part of an armistice agreement following the creation of the State of Israel, and the territory is 25 miles in length, some 5 miles in width, and now there are 1.8 million, as you said, living there, and the majority of these people are refugees who are originally inhabitants of territory that we know as being the State of Israel. And so, of course, the question of what is the future of these refugees has been a major point in the conflict in terms of trying to achieve a comprehensive agreement to resolve all elements of the conflict. Today, with these hostilities, of course, the refugee issue is sort of a subtext, if you will, of the existential crisis that's at play between Israelis and Palestinians. It's also a part of the humanitarian problem because you have a largely refugee population that is aid dependent and that has been aid dependent for quite some time, which is largely due to the circumstances of the blockade over the Gaza Strip today. But ultimately, you do have people that have been waiting for decades for a solution to their problems, and it's a layer of how people, Palestinians, view Israel and view their future.
Well, we're dealing with another crisis at the moment, Leila Hilal, and that is, of course, between Ukraine and Russia. And the Russian media is an alternative universe from the Western media. And it does feel, in many ways, from talking to our previous guest in Jerusalem, that the Israeli media is becoming kind of an alternative universe as well. And in terms of one of the narratives, I've been getting a lot of email from right-wing supporters of Israel. You know, Israel fires rockets to save children. Hamas fires rockets to kill children. One of the other things that's often said is that Israel gave up Gaza. And what did the Palestinians do? They installed a religious fascist government instead of installing a government that could have helped the people in Gaza. So just walk us through your response to that, to those, what can we call them, slogans.
Well, I think that there's a lot of effort right now to try to narrate what's happening so that Israel is the victim and the Palestinians are the aggressor. But we need to look underneath that dominant narrative and look at the facts and figures which tell their own story. You have 625 Palestinians killed as of about an hour ago. There are 27 Israelis that have been killed since the start of this rocket and this current set of hostilities. 25 of the dead on the Israeli side are soldiers, and most of the rockets are intercepted by the Iron Dome system, which the U.S. subsidizes. Meanwhile, the Palestinians are living in this densely populated area. The majority of the deaths are civilians, and Israel is effectively occupying the Gaza Strip through its blockade of land, sea, and air. So it is a misnomer to say that Hamas is responsible for civilian deaths. And I think that rather than get caught up in the tit-for-tat, we need to think about how to protect civilians and address civilian needs who are not being incendiary, who are not the majority, who are not the... I mean, I do think that the Israeli right wing constitutes a large segment of the Israeli population, but it is not all of Israel. Israel is not a monolith, and the Palestinians are not a monolith, and Hamas is not representing all of the Palestinians. And so we need to focus more on just trying to get to addressing the root of the conflict, resolving the elements of the conflict, and protecting civilians.
But just to deal with the idea that Israel magnanimously gave up this territory and that instead of improving the lives of the Palestinians, you've got this dreadful religious fanatic government, which it is. Hamas means zeal in Arabic. They are, you know, that's an apt description of them. But it seems to me that misses the point, that the Palestinians in Gaza have never had economic autonomy. They've never had a port, an airport. They've never been able to trade. They can only fish 4 miles off the coast. I mean, isn't it more apt to describe it as the British Prime Minister did, as an outdoor prison?
Well, first, it is an open-air prison. I think that the Palestinians who live there, who were born in 1993, would have never left the Gaza Strip. There's no... 80% of the population is aid-dependent because there is no ability to export goods right now. There's only some humanitarian supplies coming in, and that's not enough, which is in part why you had the tunnels being dug in the first place. So I think that when the Israelis evacuated in 2005, took out their settlers, they didn't leave the territory, they didn't end the occupation. That occupation has been maintained, and it's in fact gotten worse in terms of the movement of people and goods. And you have a situation now where the UN is saying that Gaza will be uninhabitable in 2020. So there's no magnanimity on the part of the Israelis, to be honest with you. It's quite a devastating situation. And the more people are able to respond to this distortion of the narrative and look at the facts of the situation and the human need, the better we will be and the closer we will be to actually addressing the real problems.
Well, Leila Hilal, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Leila Hilal, who's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and previously she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiation Department and advised the Palestinian Constitution Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law. She acted as an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team as part of the Annapolis Bilateral Peace Talks of 2008, and was also a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the Republican primaries underway today in Georgia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bob Moser, who is a senior editor at National Journal and author of Blue Dixie, Awakening the South's Democratic Majority. He is the former editor of the Texas Observer, senior editor writer at The Nation, and executive editor of The American Prospect. His latest article at The American Prospect is A Bridge in Georgia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Moser.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And obviously the primary election for the Republicans is underway in Georgia. However, Bob, my understanding is that only about 10,000 people are going to vote in this at best. So all this money, all these negative ads, all this beating up on each other, the two Republican candidates at the end of the day, is being decided by fewer than 10,000 people.
Well, that's exactly right. The Republicans rescheduled their original primary in Georgia for earlier in the year to attract more voters, but they didn't realize that by state law they couldn't do anything about their runoff, and they had five candidates to start with, so they were bound to have a runoff. And the two candidates, David Perdue and Jack Kingston, Kingston's a congressman. David Perdue is the cousin of former Governor Sonny Perdue. Both are running as they're basically traditional conservatives, but have been running against Tea Partiers in the primary, and so they've been they've put themselves fairly far to the right.
But the David Perdue, who's the former Dollar General CEO, he's the cousin of the former popular governor, Sonny Perdue, and the other candidate is a two-term congressman, Jack Kingston. In terms of Michelle Nunn, the Democrat, who's going to be running, the daughter of the longtime Democratic senator from Georgia, Sam Nunn, I take it that, well, from your point of view, it'd be more, for everybody's point of view, it'd be more interesting, I guess, if she runs against Jack Kingston, because there wouldn't be a lot of daylight between her and Perdue. And I guess she could also run against Washington if she did that, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And Kingston has been, Kingston has a voting record, which David Perdue and Michelle Nunn do not have. And so that gives her something to attack him on to begin with. But in some ways, as you say, Perdue and Nunn are running very similar campaigns. People who remember Senator Sam Nunn remember that he was one of the original blue dogs in Congress and one of the most conservative Democrats. And his daughter is very much in the same mold. And so it's going to be, she was hoping that she would draw a really hardcore Tea Party opponent, and there were a few in the Republican primary, but the primary voters, few as they were, went for the more traditional conservative, and that's making it more difficult for Michelle Nunn.
So is there such a thing as a dino? I know the rhino is the pejorative Republican in name only for those Republicans who, to the right of the people that they're criticizing. In this case, Michelle Nunn barely mentions being a Democrat. She's against Obamacare. And, you know, how the hell is she going to inspire the African-American voters out and white progressives?
Well, that's exactly the problem. You know, she's really running on the old formula that Southern Democrats used from starting in the post-civil rights era, and a formula that her father and Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton all helped to devise. And it was really a formula that took black voters largely for granted, and courted white voters who were somewhat in the middle or who were still registered Democratic and but were leaning Republican. And the problem with that is simply that the population has changed so much in states like Georgia that you cannot win as a Democrat anymore by appealing to white voters in the middle. You have to have, in Georgia, they're going to have record turnout from African Americans. And it's difficult to see how someone who's running on a platform, like you said, of wanting to, quote, reform Obamacare, the same thing that Republicans say, and as a military hawk in the style of her father, and someone who wants to cut corporate taxes, she's not offering much to really excite African American voters at this point.
So what's your sense then of whether these states, these red states, could turn blue? I know you've written about it, and obviously that would be the music to the ears of a lot of Democratic strategists. But on the other hand, the big caveat with this midterm coming up is that Democrats just don't show up. And the president himself has been out on the campaign trail. Even went so far as to say that Democrats have a genetic problem of that they don't vote in midterms. So if turnout is what would make the difference, and she's not going to inspire the turnout, what's all this talk about the possibility that the Democrats can hold on some of these seats in the South, or win some, in this case, in Georgia?
Well, I think what she could do, the reason that she does have a chance to win, is that she, because of her legacy in part, because Sam Nunn is, he's no longer very well remembered nationally, but in Georgia, he's very much beloved, and certainly even much more than Jimmy Carter, actually. And I think, and she's banking on the idea that there's a lot of investment going on in voter registration for African Americans. There's a group called the New Georgia Project that's run by an up-and-coming progressive African-American legislator, and a lot of money coming in from national Democratic groups to register folks. And there's actually been one of the things that's changed in recent elections as the African-American population has risen dramatically in a state like Georgia. The turnout for African-Americans has also been rising. And so their hope is that the drop-off will not be as dramatic for the midterm year as it has been in past years, and that there are still some white voters who are persuadable. And I think it's going to be a test of both of those things. But Democratic candidates in states like North Carolina and Georgia that are over time demographically going in a Democratic direction are kind of stuck in the middle now, because there aren't enough African-American voters who are registered and turning out to put them over the top quite yet. But they're blowing their opportunity long term to really charge up those voters as well.
But across the South, where Democrats are either trying to hold on to the Senate seats or win some, the good news, I guess, is Kentucky, because Mitch McConnell is simply not liked at all. We saw what happened in Mississippi with Thad Cochran, who was elected by African-American Democrats, leaving a lot of bitterness there with the Tea Party challenger. In Arkansas, there was an expectation that Democratic incumbent Mark Pryor would lose, but it turns out that Tom Cotton, the war veteran and Tea Party favorite, he's turned out to be a wooden ideologue. So is that what's going on here, that the Democrats are just simply lucky to have these people running against them?
Well, that certainly is part of it. That's one of the reasons that they're competitive. I mean, I think that it's partly the demographics, that they're just better with every election cycle for Democrats in most of these states. But it's also a really singularly bad collection of Republican candidates. And that's true also in North Carolina, another key Senate race where Senator Kay Hagan is not particularly popular, also a moderate Democrat. But she has the good fortune of running against one of the least liked politicians in the state, the Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis, who is blamed by a lot of people for very unpopular right-wing policies that have been passed in the last couple of years. So definitely the Democrats are getting some lucky breaks. And that's certainly true, as you say, in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell is less popular than President Obama.
Again, I'm speaking with Bob Moses, the senior editor at National Journal and author of Blue Dixie, Awakening the South's Democratic Majority. He is the former editor of the Texas Observer, senior editor-writer at The Nation, and executive editor of The American Prospect, where his latest article is A Bridge in Georgia. So turning to the other southern state, and of course you were a senior editor and writer for the Texas Observer, Governor Perry is certainly making headlines, and I think it's pretty clear that he's trying to run for president again. And frankly, I'd welcome to see him in the Republican debate.
I think all journalists would be happy to do that.
But he's is there anybody in Texas there that's calling him out? I mean, first of all, he refused Medicaid money, which impacts millions of poor people in that state. No skin off his nose, federal money. He turned it down because he wanted to suck up to the Tea Party wing of the party.
Yeah.
And then now he's sending the National Guard down to the border to interdict these children coming in from Central America who are surrendering to the Border Patrol. I mean, they're not sneaking in as felons, as he's implying here. Or in fact, stating. I mean, these people are trying to, you know, looking for water, anybody to surrender to. I mean, it's a farce, isn't it?
Well, it is a farce. And I think that what you know, this is the strongest sign yet, aside from Rick Perry starting to don glasses and trying to look studious, that he is definitely running for president, because this is something that is not going to be as popular in Texas as it is for Tea Partiers elsewhere in the country. For one thing, the price tag for Texans is going to be $12 million a month for this deployment. And Texans know that the crisis, you know, the crisis and what he's claiming is this epidemic of border crime doesn't really exist, not on the Texas side of the border. And, you know, so I think that he's, you know, he's basically, he's not running for office in Texas anymore. And I think he is going to get a lot of backlash there, and already is getting a lot of backlash there. But this is transparently a move to make himself look like a commander-in-chief type, deploying the National Guard and giving it a name, Operation Strong Safety, that sounds like an invasion of a foreign country.
Well, has there been manifestations, though, Bob Moser, of nativism and xenophobia, as we saw here in California in Murrieta, where local blocked buses full of these children coming from overcrowded shelters in Texas into California? I haven't heard anything in the press that the Texans are treating these kids badly.
No, I haven't heard any evidence of that. And in fact, the you know, there have been a lot of promises made, not by Perry, but by the National Guard folks and everyone else involved, that they're going to make every, you know, attempt to treat the kids humanely. You know, this is really just nothing but a political stunt on his part.
So just in the overall picture, though, of the South, that's now that the, you know, the Republican Party has become a Southern party, I think that's fair to say. And in the last two cycles, neither Kerry in 2004 or Al Gore in 2000 won the South. And in fact, I remember personally arguing with Kerry, saying, you know, because he said if he didn't support the Iraq War vote, he would never pick up a vote in the South. Well, guess what? He didn't. And he supported that ridiculous war. So that's the history. Is that changing? I mean, that's the indication I'm getting from what you're writing, is that the worst may be over for the Democrats in the South.
Well, I think that's true. And what happened with Gore and Kerry is that they basically both ceded the South. Neither of them ran serious campaigns anywhere except for Florida. And Barack Obama in 2008 took a chance on not only Florida, but North Carolina and Virginia. And the basis for that, and he almost did a full-scale campaign in Georgia as well. And the reason for that is the changing demographics in those states, and the fact that there are so many unregistered voters who just haven't been, Democrats haven't asked them for their votes for decades in some cases. So the effort paid off. He won Obamacare, North Carolina and Virginia, as well as Florida. And in North Carolina especially, brought out, you know, hundreds of thousands more African-American voters and got them into the process. And so that's the great hope for Democrats in the South, that there has been this huge remigration of African Americans from up north back to the South, especially to places like Atlanta and Charlotte, and also, of course, Latino immigration into states like Texas, that really is weakening the power of white voters. So if Democrats can make a serious effort and actually register and turn out as many minority voters as Republicans turn out white voters, they have a real chance in these states going forward.
But you're still talking about presidential races where Democrats do show up to vote, right? As opposed to midterms, you know, where they don't show up.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the real challenge. That's the real challenge this time around. And there's no history to show that Democrats in these states will show up for midterms. And so that gets back to the quandary that we were talking about before, that
Right.
You know, these candidates are appealing to the voters who already vote, but the voters they need are the voters who haven't been voting.
And President Obama is not likely to head up a ticket and try and inspire people. He may in some states, but his popularity is pretty sunken into the basement, hasn't it?
It has, although his popularity in most southern states is basically the same as his national average, which is pretty bad. But
right.
But I think there's a general perception that he would be doing even worse in the South, and that's not the case because his approval numbers among African-American voters and Latino voters and younger voters, the Democratic base, is still pretty high, even in those states.
Right. Well, maybe he should campaign then.
Well,
the candidates are running away from him, though, aren't they? All these Democrats we've talked about?
Oh, they're absolutely running away from him, and I think that it's a mistake. I mean, for instance, you know, in Georgia, you could imagine a really huge rally with Barack Obama, you know, embracing Michelle Nunn sort of late October to really just galvanize turnout and having, you know, Georgia's many civil rights legends on the stage with him. It really would galvanize turnout. You know, the fear that Democrats have is that it would also galvanize white people's turnout, but white people already turn out. So it's one more example. There's a real kind of almost superstitious clinging to the old formula that Democrats used to be able to use in the South to appeal to white voters, and that's a formula that's not going to work anymore. And the problem is the new formula, aside from having Barack Obama at the top of the ticket and his machine come into your state, hasn't been invented yet.
Well, Bob Moser, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bob Moser, who's a senior editor at National Journal and the author of Blue Dixie, Awakening the South's Democratic Majority. He is the former editor of the Texas Observer, senior editor writer at The Nation, and executive editor of The American Prospect. His latest article at The American Prospect is A Bridge in Georgia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.